This show is brought to you by SeatGeek, the perfect place to buy and sell tickets. Hey everyone, welcome to another episode of the Vertical Podcast with Chris Mannix, and we have a terrific show for you today. Rodney Hood, the second-year forward for the Utah Jazz, he'll join the podcast to talk about his transition from Mississippi State to Duke and Duke to the NBA. And Mike Monroe, the longtime beat writer with the San Antonio Spurs, talks about covering one of the most successful and one of the most difficult teams in the NBA. That's next, the Vertical Podcast with Chris Mannix.
Yahoo Sports presents the Vertical Podcast with Chris Mannix. Powered by digital media. Find your voice. And now, your host, Chris Mannix.
Hey everybody, welcome back. Vertical Podcast with Chris Mannix. Glad you could join me. I'm here in the New York City podcast studios and looking forward to this show today. A guy that I've been pretty high on for most of the last couple of years, Rodney Hood, the second-year guard from the Utah Jazz, a player that, frankly, I thought was completely overlooked coming out of Duke and landed in the laps of a very grateful Utah Jazz team. So I'm looking forward to talking to Rodney, and let's bring Rodney in right now. Rodney, thanks for joining me. You grew up in Mississippi. That's football country. What was it like for you as a basketball player growing up in Mississippi?
I think it's really good athletes down there. You know, it's more of a football state, and, a lot of football players play basketball. So, basketball kind of takes the back seat. But, it got me tougher. You know, a lot of guys try to rough you up. And, you know, we're a little bit behind schedule as far as the national schedule. Like, we don't play national schedule, but we do play a lot of competitive basketball. So it was great playing down there. It got me a lot tougher.
I mean, it is. You're right. It's a football town, a football area. Were you into football?
Oh, yeah, most definitely. You know, being around SEC country, you know, watching, you know, the Auburns, Mississippi State, Alabama, you know, all those towns are, you know, within 2 hours of where I'm from. And, you know, you can't help but to enjoy football and, fall in love with it. So it definitely was I was a big fan growing up.
What was it? Did you play football as well, or were you just playing basketball?
Yeah, I played football when I was younger until I got to about 13, and then I gave it up. You know, I was too skinny, and I started to hit a growth spurt. So, and plus basketball, I knew that was always my first love, so I just stuck with basketball.
You were a heavily recruited guy coming out of high school. I mean, it seemed like, just reading about your recruitment, it seemed like it was a pretty crazy time with teams trying to get you. How crazy was it for you?
It was crazy. You know, just especially my junior year, you know, you'll walk into the gym and one of my practices, and then you'll see, you know, some legendary coaches, you know, in the gym. And, you know, it was just crazy because you never see that, especially down in Mississippi. And, you know, it was a big thing. You know, I was all over the news and everything. So it was just great, you know, just having that opportunity to visit schools and talk to coaches and get to know people and develop relationships. And, it was just good that I chose the school that I chose.
Did you have one of those moments where, whether it's, you know, a couple of coaches in the gym, where you're like, holy crap, this is real?
Yeah, definitely. I remember back out of high school when, Rick Pitino came down to Mississippi and, you know, and watched me practice. I think that was the biggest thing. You know, he's a legendary coach, one of the best to ever do it. And when he came down there, that was a pretty big thing.
What was your interactions like with Pitino?
It was great. You know, we had a great relationship. You know, we talked, and, you know, he really wanted me to come to Louisville. And, you know, I was close to picking Louisville, you know, out of high school. And, I just felt like it was just safe for me to stay at Mississippi State, you know, for my freshman year.
What changed for you in college? Because you're at Mississippi State. Then in 2012, you decide to transfer to Duke. What went into that decision?
It was just a new situation. You know, my coach left. You know, all his staff left. People that I got comfortable with. You know, all my teammates, you know, left, and, you know, it was basically a fresh program, you know, so I just wanted to start over new somewhere else, you know, be able to play on that national stage. And, you know, as soon as I decided to transfer, you know, Coach K was one of the first coaches to call, and, you know, I pretty much thought it was a no-brainer. But, you know, after I went and took the visit to Duke, you know, I just knew, you know, that was the best place for me to go, you know, to further my career.
There's probably not many more different cultures, I would imagine, than Mississippi State and Duke. I mean, were they? I mean, how much different were they, Rodney?
I mean, they're completely opposite. You know, I mean, it's good people around both programs. You know, great people. But Mississippi State is more of a football school, a national, more of a public school. You know, Duke is a private school, but it's all basketball. You know, it's just different, you know. And then, you know, Mississippi State, we barely played on TV. At Duke, you play on TV, you know, almost every single game. So it was just different cultures, you know, from day to day. And, you know, it was, like I said, I had great times at both schools, but I think Duke was just better for me and to get me to the point where I am now.
Was it tough to adjust to the lifestyle, the academics, all the things that kind of separate Duke from maybe other schools out there?
Yeah, I mean, it was a little bit, but, you know, the coaching staff, my academic advisors, my teammates, they all welcomed me with open arms and made sure, you know, I got off to a good start. You know, it was smooth sailing from there, you know, since I got there in the summer.
You had to sit out the 12-13 season because of transfer rules, which I think are pretty stupid in college basketball. I mean, how hard was that year for you to have to step back and not play the game?
It was especially hard. You know, I knew that going in when I was transferred, I was going to have to sit out. You know, it was even more hard because, you know, during that year, it was a lot of guys getting granted the opportunity to play and getting waivers to play. And, you know, that was tough for me as well. So, but, you know, I just supported my teammates, you know, that whole year. I got a lot better. I was able to practice against, you know, pros, you know, Mason Plumlee, Ryan Kelly, and Seth Curry. You know, just going up against Seth every single day made me a lot better player because he was one of the better college players that year. And, you know, it just made me better. And, you know, I got a chance to focus on my schoolwork and, you know, just become a better person. And, you know, and I just took off the next year.
Isn't it nuts that they make you sit out a year? I mean, your coach can leave or retire. Other coaches can go get other jobs. But they make players like you and many, many others sit out a year before they go play for another school.
Yeah, I mean, it's crazy. It's crazy. You know, I don't know why the rule was put into place. And, you know, but, you know, like you said, you know, everybody gets a chance to further their career right away. You know, coaches and, you know, everybody else get to go and coach right away to another school and don't get to sit out. And, you know, kids got to, you know, sit out a year. You know, it's not like I just left because I just one day I woke up and felt like leaving, you know. Everybody in the program left, so I decided to leave as well. But, you know, it's part of it. You know, when I decided to transfer, I knew that was the rule, whether I agree with it or not. But, you know, it made me a better person. I'm not going to downplay it.
For people that don't understand or have never been at Cameron Indoor Stadium, how would you describe the atmosphere at a game like that? Duke, North Carolina, describe that atmosphere at Cameron.
Man, it's amazing. It's an amazing atmosphere, you know. Duke, North Carolina is just off the Richter scale, you know, just from the fans being on top of you, you know, it's loud, you know, when we go on a run, you know, the floor gets to shaking, you know, it's just an amazing college atmosphere. You know, it's none like, you know, I don't think it'll ever be a college atmosphere like that, you know, at a basketball game. You know, it's just amazing feeling. And, you know, I miss playing there. I miss being a part of that.
No, nobody likes players from Duke, at least around the country. So I'm sure you, when you went places, did you get the traditional trash talk that I'm sure other fan bases throw at Duke guys?
No, not really, because we had a good team, even though we didn't finish the way we wanted to. But we had a good team, and, you know, we had a lot of likable guys on the team. So it wasn't like they was saying, you know, crazy things to me and Jabari and, you know, other guys on our team. But, you know, you definitely sense the Duke hate, especially around the Chapel Hill area. You know, North Carolina, people don't like us. You know, NC State, you know, all throughout that North Carolina area, people don't like us. But people do respect us, you know, regardless of the hate and the what they say about us. You know, they still respect us and what Coach K has been able to accomplish at Duke.
Sounds like they were pretty nice to you.
Well, not nice, but they wasn't, you know. They weren't going off like the old Christian Leitner days like they was back then.
Oh, nothing was as bad as that. Nothing could possibly compare to that.
Yeah, that was crazy.
Did you ever get to meet Leitner when you were at Duke?
I didn't get a chance to meet him. Probably in passing one time, but I didn't get a chance to meet him.
When you decided to go pro, did you have it in your head where you might go in the draft? Did you have any early thoughts about, all right, well, I had a great junior year. I put up good numbers. I think I'm going to go somewhere between X and Y. Did you have those thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, going into the process, you know, I got some opinions, and, you know, they was telling me I could go from late lottery to mid-first round, so between 10 and 20, which is a broad range, and I thought I was good enough to go through the in that area with the workouts and proving myself and everything. And, you know, going into draft night, I thought the same thing, you know, but it didn't pan out. But, you know, it's just a blessing, you know, me being able to come here to Utah in a perfect situation for me.
Yeah, I mean, look, I'm not blowing smoke up your ass here, but I never could understand why you fell to number 23. You put up the big numbers at Duke. You went to the Combine, and the coaches out there told me when you were there, you were probably the best player at the Combine. Could you figure out, once the draft process was over, what people were skeptical about with you?
To be very honest, I really don't know. You know, I haven't even tried to look into it. You know, after that time passed, I just moved on. But, you know, I wonder about it all the time. But, you know, like I said, it's a blessing just to be here. And, you know, that time was a good learning experience for me. You know, it made me want to prove myself even more. You know, it was just a great moment for me. Even though I was down at the moment, you know, it was something I always remember.
Did you hear the he has a long neck complaint?
Nah.
You didn't hear that?
Nah,
oh, that's what I heard that, Rodney. I'm telling you. I heard it after you fell to 23. Some executives would say to me, well, he's 6'8", but he's got a long neck, so he's not really 6'8".
Nah, I never heard that before.
I'm telling you, it's some bizarre stuff. I mean, that, and I think there's this strange idea amongst NBA people that you can't draft guys that are like over the age of 21. If you're over the age of 21 in the draft, you're all of a sudden old.
Yeah, I mean, that's crazy to me. I feel like people think, you know, because guys are younger, they have more potential and things like that. But, you know, I did 3 years in college. You know, it's plenty of guys, you know, Steph Curry. I think he did 3 years, right?
Yeah, 3 years at Davidson.
Yeah, him, Damian Lillard did years in college. You know, it's plenty of people that did 2 or 3 years in college and 4 years in college. There's, you know, NBA superstars and stars and went on to become all-stars. So, you know, it's just what they're gauging on. And that's fine. That's cool, you know, but it's just about getting better, just proving yourself. You know, you can't be, you know, get caught up in, you know, this guy's younger and, you know, he's supposed to be better in the long run. You know, I don't personally agree with that, you know, but, you know, that's what it is.
Yeah, I mean, people forget it used to be exactly like this. It was juniors and seniors every single year. Tim Duncan, maybe the best player, one of the best players in NBA history, went 4 years at Wake Forest. It's incredible how things have kind of changed, that you just draft young guys who don't have the pedigree that you had coming out of Duke. But you come out of Duke and you're the 23rd pick in the draft that year. Are you the kind of guy that sits back and says, I feel like I should have gone higher. I'm going to wear that as a chip on my shoulder, you know, for my first year. I'm going to use that to motivate me in my first year.
Yeah, I was real disappointed that night. But, you know, as I sat down and just thought about it, you know, I got my foot in the door and I'm going to a great situation. And that's how I looked at it from that point forward. You know, I was going to get a chance to play. And just because, you know, guys got picked in front of me, you know, they might be going to a team where they might not get the opportunity. So, you know, it was, like I said, it was a blessing in disguise, but I definitely had a chip on my shoulder. And I wanted to prove just to myself and to my peers, not necessarily the GM, but to prove to my peers that, you know, I belonged in, you know, the top, especially the lottery pick. I deserve to be a lottery pick, but it just drives me to be where I am today, you know, still trying to prove that.
Hey, Rodney, hang on for just 1 second for me. I know you're in the middle of basketball season, but it's also the start of baseball season. A long, long season, which could be a great season. A lot of games, 2,430 in all, 162 even if you only follow one team. That's a lot of games to keep up with, and sometimes you want to watch your team while you're on the go. Thanks to Binge On, only from T-Mobile, you can stream your favorite team's games without using any data. T-Mobile is giving its customers and anyone who switches a free year-long MLB.TV premium subscription. That's $109.99 value for free, so you'll never miss a game, and none of it will ever touch your data plan. With Binge On, only from T-Mobile, you can watch every out-of-market game and get your stats, highlights, and scores of your favorite team without using any data. T-Mobile has got you covered, unlike those other guys. So get your free MLB.TV premium subscription by April 10th and catch every moment all season long. Hurry up. You can only sign up during the opening week of the baseball season through April 10th. Switch to the Uncarrier today and catch games all season long. Already a T-Mobile customer? Sign up at T-Mobile.com/MLB. Sign up for MLB.TV while on our network. New MLB.TV premium subscribers only. Blackout and other restrictions apply. Visit MLB.tv for details. Binge on available to T-Mobile customers with qualifying plan. Detectable video typically streams at DVD quality. Video from participating services doesn't count against full speed data on our U.S. network. Third-party subscription charges may apply.
You're listening to the Vertical Podcast with Chris Mannix.
When did you know in that first year, maybe it took your second year, I don't know, but when did you know that, you know, I can be an NBA player, that this game, that it's going to be something that I'm successful at? Because a lot of guys, obviously, you look at the draft over the years, a lot of guys come into the draft and they're not. For whatever one reason or the other, they don't pan out as NBA players. They could be huge college stars, but they don't pan out as NBA players. You came in, averaged about 8.5 points your first year. Now you're up to around 15 per game. Was there a moment in these last 2 years when it kind of came to you like, all right, I can do this. I'm going to be really good at this.
I kind of always had that confidence, but it really happened after All-Star break last year. You know, we were rolling as a team, and, you know, I got a chance to, you know, play extended minutes. And, you know, I had a couple good games. I think against Charlotte, I had 24, and, you know, I hit a lot of threes that game. And, you know, it felt good. You know, it felt natural. And I kept playing good after All-Star break. So that game was probably the game where I felt like, you know, I belong and, you know, I could do some really good things in the league.
You're on a team that's one of the younger teams in the league. I think you guys got like 10 years older when you got Shelvin Mack on the roster. You totally screwed up your youngest team in the league label. But is it a good thing for you to be on such a young team? You mentioned that you were going to get playing time right away. Was it good for you to be on a team with a bunch of guys that are right around your same age?
Yeah, it's great. It's great. You know, we're all young. You know, even Coach Snyder is young, you know, as far as being a head coach. And, you know, it's been great for us, you know, just being able to lean on each other, you know, every single day. And, you know, it's kind of like a college atmosphere. You know, we all learning at the same time and trying to pull each other through. So it's been an amazing experience, you know, and we're fun. We're embracing that being young role in the league and being in position we're in now, almost making the playoffs is amazing.
You know, you mentioned the second half of the season and the way you guys played. Really got it rolling the second half of the year last year. One of the flashpoints of last year was when you traded Enes Kanter and Rudy became the guy in the middle and the rotation was kind of set. What changed after you traded away Kanter and the new rotation kind of was set in?
I just think we locked in. You know, the whole year we weren't winning games, but Coach Snyder did a tremendous job of just keep making sure we're still working hard, working on our defensive habits, making sure we're getting better and developing. And I think, you know, we just hit stride at the All-Star break, you know, regardless of Enes was there or not. You know, I think we were going to hit a stride. And, you know, Rudy really excelled, getting more minutes and playing their role as our center and, you know, blocking shots, him and Fave down there anchoring. And our defense just picked it up and able to win some games and get some confidence. And I just think we just hit stride at the All-Star break last year.
Have you ever dunked on Rudy Gobert at practice?
Nah. Rudy doesn't jump in practice. Rudy, he'll jump in the game. He'll come from the weak side, but in practice, he doesn't want anybody, you know, lingering in over his head, him getting dunked on. So we haven't tried him yet.
So nobody's tried.
I think Alec Burke got him one time. I think so.
You end last year, and there's a lot of optimism that you're going to take the next step this year. You guys have played well, and you're right there in the mix for the playoff spot. But losing Dante when you did this summer, what did that do to the team?
Man, it was tough. You know, he's been he had a great first year. You know, defensively, he's great. You know, on point guards, him being long and athletic. And, you know, he was developing, playing summer league and getting better. And, you know, it's just unfortunate that happened. You know, they put a big dip in our team. But, you know, we went on and we had to move on. But, you know, especially him and then Alec Burke missing a lot of time, you know, they really I wouldn't say hindered our team, but, you know, we can only imagine what it would have been like if those two guys were playing at full strength the whole year. But, you know, Mr. Dante was big for our team this year. But we're still right there in the boat, and hopefully we get him back next year.
Yeah, you are right there in the mix, obviously, for one of the final few playoff spots. I mean, is this something you guys talk about in the locker room, about getting into the playoffs, getting that taste of a postseason experience, even if it does mean playing one of those, you know, incredibly great teams like Golden State or San Antonio in the first round?
Yeah, I mean, we've been talking about it. You know, we definitely want to get into the playoffs and get that experience and play against a great team and get a feel for it. I think they'll only help us in future years. And right now we just control what we can control. You know, other teams are winning, we're winning. So it's going to come down to the last couple of games and, you know, we'll see what happens. But right now we just got to control what we can control and try to win every game we play from here on out.
Does getting picked 23rd still tick you off?
No, not really, because I think I proved that to a certain extent that, you know, I was better than some of the guys that picked before me, you know. So I kind of moved past that, and I'm trying to just be the best player I can be now, you know. And but I still, it's still in the back of my mind, but that's not what drives me anymore. I'm trying to help this team get to where it needs to be, and that's at the top of the West. So that's my goal right now.
How many guys drafted ahead of you do you still know? Do you still know the names of everybody drafted ahead of you?
Yeah, I know. I know in order. I know everybody.
Yeah. Does it get you when you see them? Do you sort of mark that down when you get an opportunity to play against, T.J. Warren, Zach LaVine, guys like that?
Yeah, I respect those guys. You know, it's not a guy that I think is just horrible that got picked before me. But, you know, it's just, you just want to prove it. And I'm sure, you know, if I was picked before them, they want to prove to me that they deserve to be picked before me. So this is how it is. This is how it goes as competitors. And, but every single time you get a chance to play against, you know, other good young players, you know, you want to try to prove yourself.
Well, Rodney, congratulations on a terrific first 2 years in the NBA. Good luck during this playoff stretch. And thanks for coming on the podcast. I appreciate it.
I appreciate it.
Thanks, Rodney.
It's the Vertical Podcast with Chris Mannix.
All right. Well, my next guest has been covering the NBA for almost as long as I've been alive. He's been covering the San Antonio Spurs for more than a decade, first for the San Antonio Express News, and now for the Rivard Report. He's Mike Monroe, the terrific beat writer, longtime NBA columnist, and he joins me here on the podcast. Mike, how many years for you on that Spurs beat?
Well, the Spurs, per se, the last 12 years, and of course, I started covering the NBA when I was at the Denver Post in 1985, so it's been a while.
What were you covering at the Post, at the Denver Post?
Well, I covered the Nuggets to start with, and then later became the NBA reporter at large for the Denver Post, and I had a three-year stretch with FoxSports.com as their NBA columnist and reporter from 2000 to 2003, and then took a job with the Express News, it was a completely different experience covering the San Antonio Spurs as opposed to the Denver Nuggets.
Yeah, I mean, in what ways? I mean, we all know the Spurs are—I don't want to call them difficult per se, but we'll get into more of that later on. But yeah, the biggest differences between covering the Spurs and covering any other team you've been around.
Well, long playoff runs, that's one immediate difference. The Nuggets, when I was covering them, never got past the second round. But the Spurs, you know, the second round is typically a given. But the professionalism of the organization is in stark contrast to a lot of others. You're right, it can be a little more difficult on the media than other organizations, but it's interesting, and you deal with some legendary players for sure. The big three, in my view, are all Hall of Famers. It's not often you're dealing with a team that has three Hall of Famers. It's fun.
So much has changed, Mike, in covering the game, and I got into it not recently, but, you know, certainly relatively recently, back in 2003 when social media was kind of just getting started, and I kind of came up with it. But covering the game in the 1980s and covering the Nuggets back then, how much different was the way the game was covered than it is right now?
You know, I had a discussion with Howard Beck and Michael Lee last season. I was sort of kvetching a little bit about my lot in professional life at that point. And Howard Beck says, wait a minute, you got to cover the NBA during the golden years of media coverage of the NBA. And he's right. When I first started on the beat in 1985, typical of most beat writers at the time, you flew on the same plane as the team. Now, the teams hadn't yet gone to charter aircraft. Or having their own planes. And so everyone flew commercially, and you would get, before the season began, you would get the itinerary for the team, and you would book the same flights, and when you arrived in wherever you were going, you would get on the team bus at the airport and go to the team hotel where you had also booked your hotel room, and you would very often ride the bus to the games and maybe take a cab home because you had to stay and write your story. But it was so starkly different than what it is now, because the players got to, and everyone involved with the team, they got to see you, they got to know you as a person, as opposed to a guy, just, you know, some guy who's sticking a tape recorder in their face at practices and before and after games. You know, you had instances where, you know, you had mechanical difficulties on the planes and everybody's hanging out in the airport together. And, you know, you might go to a coffee shop with two or three players, get something to eat, maybe even engage in a card game or something. It was a different world. And, the advent of the, you know, the team plane changed the dynamics of the relationship between everyone involved with the team and the players that they covered.
Hey, Mike, hang on just for 1 second, because I want to tell you a little bit about SeatGeek. Have you ever been frustrated trying to buy tickets online? Most sites make it complicated, and they all try to sneak in huge fees at checkout. That's why you need to try SeatGeek. SeatGeek has taken all the work and hassle out of shopping for tickets. They pull all the tickets available on other sites into one place, so you save time and you never miss a deal. You can even set alerts for upcoming events, and SeatGeek will let you know if ticket prices fall. Even better, every ticket on SeatGeek is ranked based on value, so you can immediately find underpriced seats, and before you buy, you can use SeatGeek's detailed maps to see the view from your seat. Best of all, SeatGeek is always honest and upfront about the price. Unlike other ticket sites, they show you the full ticket price from start to finish and never try to trick you with huge fees on the checkout page. My listeners get a $20 rebate on their first SeatGeek purchase. To get your $20 rebate, download the free SeatGeek app, go to the Settings tab, and click Add a Promo Code. Enter promo code Mannix. SeatGeek will send you $20 after you made your first purchase. My little brother used that recently, and he got his $20 back quickly. Download the free SeatGeek app and enter promo code Mannix today.
It's the Vertical Podcast with Chris Mannix.
When you're on the plane, the regular commercial flight with these guys, were there rules, whether it was unwritten or otherwise, about what was kind of off limits, what was on limits, you know, what stuff like that?
Well, for one thing, the, you know, the players, the collective bargaining agreement mandated first class travel for the players. And so you wouldn't really interact with them on the plane. But sometimes you're on a plane where there weren't enough first class seats for all the players, and you'd get two or three or four players that had to sit in the commercial section. And the rule there was, if a player was going to be stuck in a middle or a window seat, and the media, you know, had an aisle seat, as we all often tried to book, you'd give up that aisle seat for a player, because you're talking about guys that are, you know, 6'5", 6'6", and up. And it just was a matter of practicality. But there weren't any rules per se. Now, there were rules on the bus. You know, the coaches always sat in the front. The media would sit in a row or two behind, and the players were in they all had their own individual seats on the bus. And don't ever sit in a player's seat, I'll tell you that. That was a no-no. But there were occasions where I interviewed coaches on the plane, you know, because deadlines and no practice, and, you know, that's the only chance you were going to have to talk to a coach. But not in, you know, you didn't go up and do that in first class. You know, you might tell him ahead of time, hey, I'm going to need to talk to you for a few minutes, and he might come back and you know, walk to the back of the plane and conduct an interview there. But
it must have been great to cover the game in those days, man. Just because it sounds like the access and just the players, their relationship with the writers was so much different. Nowadays, and you know this as well as I do at this point, it feels like everyone's kind of on the defensive. And when you're trying to write something, you know, compelling and most importantly, true, it just seems like it gets harder and harder, Mike, to get to what's real behind a player.
You're absolutely right. You know, for one thing, in the 80s and the first 4 or 5 years of the 90s, there was no social media. Actually, through the entire of the 90s, I don't believe there was social media, but there was less for the players to worry about in terms of what you were going to do. I mean, you're just writing stories about them, and nobody was running around with a cell phone camera to take photos of that might embarrass them. It was a completely different dynamic. I introduced Alexander Wolf at the San Antonio Book Festival. He was giving a lecture about his wonderful book, The Audacity of Hoop, Basketball in the Age of Obama. And if you haven't read that, you should. Mm. And we were talking about this very same thing. And I told him that my first assignment covering the Denver Nuggets was the Midwest Rookie Review in San Antonio in 1985, summer of 1985. And that on an off day, this was like summer league before summer league, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it was just all the teams in the Midwest Division. And here's another thing that the listeners may find amazing. There were 8 rounds of the draft back in the day. And so you had all of these draft picks that made up the summer league roster along with a few free agents. And all the teams got together and basically had a short rookie free agent camp. And then they would have this summer league after which almost everyone was cut. So there was an off day, and Doug Moe organized an outing to SeaWorld, which had just opened up in San Antonio. And I went to SeaWorld because I had a rental car. Probably got me my invitation, but I went to SeaWorld with Doug Moe and Alan Bristow, the coaches of the Nuggets, Chuck Daly and Brendan Malone, the two coaches of the Pistons in that day, and Al Menendez, a legendary scout for the Nets and later the Pacers, and Chopper Travellini, the legendary trainer of the Nuggets, plus Bill Hanslick, who was down in San Antonio doing some injury rehab work. And we spent the entire day at SeaWorld and had a great time. And whenever I would see any of those guys later on, we all had something in common, and we would talk about what a great day that was and tell this story and that story. And what a way for a young guy to break into covering the NBA, you know, go spend a day with a couple of legendary coaches and get to be, dare I say it, friends in a sort of professional way with the people that you're covering. Nothing like that ever happens anymore.
Yeah, I mean, so the team playing, the advent of that, yes, changes the dynamic some. What else changes it? I mean, social media clearly, but was there a flashpoint for that? Whether it's the rise of Twitter or blogs and the what I think is sometimes an over-credentialing by some teams for their events, which saturates the locker room with reporters.
You've hit upon it. It's the saturation of media in the locker room. Back in the day, you might be in the locker room after a game with 2 or 3 other reporters, maybe. You know, the Nuggets, you know, there were 2 papers in Denver, the Denver Post and the Rocky Mountain News. And you go to a road game, and the only people in the Nuggets locker room might be myself and whoever was covering for the Rocky Mountain News, whether it was Kevin McCullen or Dave Krieger or whoever it happened to be. We might be the only guys in there, the only media people in there. And the players were all available. They were all sitting at their lockers. And now I go in a Spurs locker room after a game, and there are conservatively at least 15 people in there, a lot of them with mini cams, a lot of bloggers with their cell phones taking video. There's no such thing anymore as a one-on-one post-game interview. It's totally different, and I regret the loss of the intimacy that you used to have with your interview subjects, where it might be, you know, for one thing, you might have an angle or a piece of information about a guy that you don't want to share with your competition. You can't do that anymore. It's just a thing of the past.
Yeah, relationships are so important for writing anything of consequence. You're not going to get somebody to say something interesting or really open up unless you have developed that relationship with them. How, the stuff you're talking about, the proliferation of media at some of these events, how much has that made it more difficult to develop the relationships you need to have with these guys?
It's almost impossible in this day. I've been in San Antonio long enough that I have some solid relationships with Spurs players. And, you know, I don't know whether I would characterize these as friendships, but, you know, it used to be that you would expect to have the phone numbers, the home phone numbers of all of the players that you covered. They kind of understood that this was important, and it was rare for a player to say, I'm not giving you my phone number. But they also, you know, implicit in this was the fact that you're not going to bother them at home. But now it's gotten rare for a player to share a cell phone number with the people that are covering. And of course, now we even have we even have the players covering themselves through the Players Tribune, right?
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah.
But the proliferation of media is, yeah, it's players now want to control their own message much more so. That never happened in the past. You know, there were teams that were notoriously difficult to deal with, like the Pistons, you know, Bill Laimbeer and some of the others in that locker room were hard to deal with. But there was a time when players understood that part of being an NBA player was representing the league and the team that they played for through the media. And it was a part of the obligation of the job, and one of the reasons that they were paid the kind of money they got paid. I don't think that understanding is there any longer.
Yeah, I would agree with you, and you've been around certainly a lot longer than I have, but it gets, you know, it just gets so difficult to get these guys to be interested necessarily in doing and sort of cooperating with a longish feature. And you're right, the ability of them to put their own message out through social media and the ability to use outlets like the Players Tribune. What do you think that players are missing, though? Like, if a player says to you, well, I can just write my own story on the Players Tribune, what's the counter argument to that? What do you say back that would make the guy understand that being involved in a story with you is a better idea?
My argument to would be, well, are you going to do all the reporting that goes along with this, talking to other people about you? Are you going to be able to get people to, you know, to honestly answer questions about you if you're the questioner? I've not faced that situation, but, you know, and I don't know that the Players Tribune is actually looking to do the sorts of takeout features that the long-form journalism that we're talking about here. But I might also, you know, say, look, you know, I would never deign to take you on in a shooting contest. You know, why do you feel like you could outright me? But maybe the Players Tribune is not a really good example of how the dynamics have changed. But the idea of they're trying to control their own message certainly is a legitimate thing. And a lot of that has to do with their agents as well and the representation that they have. So many players now have their own personal publicists who want to control their image and give them advice about how to deal with media and so forth is just not the same as it once was. And I, for one, am very grateful that I got to be part of the sort of the glory years of the NBA beat writer.
All right, so covering the Spurs, the perception out there amongst the common fan, the guy that only watches Pop's interviews on TNT or ESPN, and here's Tim Duncan's, you know, 1 to 2 word responses to questions at press conferences. You know, I have a pretty good idea of what this is, but for people that don't follow him on a regular basis, how close to reality is the perception of San Antonio?
I think it's really skewed, and Tim actually can be a very good interview if you ever get him one-on-one. Neither Pop nor Tim are very good at suffering fools. And they, you know, they sort of recoil with the occasional really dumb question. And Pop's TV thing, that's all shtick, you know? That's now something that has gotten to be a thing with him. And he is entirely capable of, he can be one of the best interview subjects going.
Yeah.
He's a brilliant guy. And I remember also back in the day when you could walk into his office before a game when you were a visiting writer and have him sit there and just get a terrific interview about whatever topic you had, you know, to talk about, whether it was one of your own players or one of his players. He's very good in responding to legitimate questions about his team. Part of what goes on now is that he has intimidated about 70% of the reporters that he deals with. Nobody wants to ask him a question for fear of what the reporters in this market call popped, you know, which I think you know what I'm talking
yeah.
about. You know, that one of those responses like, did you stay up all night thinking of that question? or the real killer, does someone have an intelligent question they'd like to ask? You know, when he's asked a bad question, you have to be willing to accept the occasional barb from Pop, and also you have to be very willing to laugh at yourself and laugh at him and go back at him on occasion. So, but Pop's thing is sort of a false artifice that he has come up with, I think, and I honestly think if someone were ever to say, Pop, you know, why do you carry this on? You know, you're kind of making a mockery of the process, which that may be his point. I don't know. But that he might rethink the whole two-word answer thing during the in-game interviews and so forth. You know, and he also has shown that he's not the jerk that people think he is in his response to Craig Sager's battle with cancer. He's been very, very kind and considerate to that whole situation. And Pop doesn't like people to see his soft side, but he does have one.
Yeah, and you're right. He can be one of, if not the best interviews when it comes to coaches out there. If you get him off to the side and he knows what story you're working on, he goes out of his way to try to be helpful. You've talked to him far more than I ever have, but every time that I go down there, and whether it's a story on LaMarcus Aldridge or Kawhi Leonard or somebody else within that organization, he always gives you something that you didn't know. And I feel like that's not always the case with coaches. Coaches might say a lot of words, but they won't tell you anything. Pop will tell you something. There'll always be something in that conversation that you have with him that he gives up that you didn't know before.
Absolutely. Again, you know, Alex Wolf and I had, I'm sure most of your listeners know who Alex Wolf
sure.
is, a wonderful writer. For
SI writer, yep.
He was telling me how awesome Pop was talking about Patty Mills. He wrote Alex wrote a wonderful piece about Patty Mills and his background as an Indigenous Australian and his heritage and what it means to him and so forth. And he said Pop just could not have been more forthcoming with information about this story because he felt it was important for people to understand Patty and appreciate, you know, his legacy as an Indigenous Australian, and wanted people to know about the background of all Indigenous Australians and what they've gone through. So Pop can be one of the best. I wish it were more often.
How would you characterize the relationship between Pop and R.C. Buford? Because whenever people are discussing why the Spurs are the Spurs, it's always Pop and R.C. Buford at the top of that organization. How have they been able to be so successful for so long in a league where everyone seems to be an interchangeable part?
That's a great question. You know, and I think you have to go back to the ownership of the club that has stuck by them for such a long time. They got past all of the roadblocks that a first-time coach and a first-time GM have to establish the longevity that they need. I mean, after the first few years of the Pop RC leadership, they won a championship, and then a few years later they won the second, and then the third. You know, they established this dynasty, and they sort of had tenure at that point. But now I mean. Pop can be here as long as he wants to, and so can RC. So I think you have to give a lot of credit to the ownership group, which had been under the direction of Peter Holt, and now he's stepped away. And eventually, I think his son Peter, I think he eventually is going to take over as the CEO of the team I'm not privy to the inside information there, but that's what it seems like to me. But, you know, Peter was always, he recognized what he had, and he did everything to support what they did and stayed out of the way, which is what great owners actually do. They do to support the people that they trust, the people that they hire to run the team, and then stay out of the way and support the financial decisions that they make.
This team has been the most successful sports franchise of the four major sports over the last right around 20 years. But I said before the season, Mike, that I thought this team this year had the chance to be the best Spurs team of that last two decade type of era. And, you know, regular season wise, it certainly looks that way. You've seen a lot of, you know, variations of this Spurs franchise. Where does this year's team stack up compared to the others?
Well, I agree with you, and I said the same thing, that I thought it could be the best team. I didn't think they would have the best record, however, because I thought it was going to take longer for LaMarcus Aldridge and David West and, you know, the other new players to assimilate into the Spurs system. And because LaMarcus Aldridge was going to be a really real key piece, I thought it was going to take the other Spurs, the veteran Spurs, a little longer to adjust to him as well. It didn't take that long, and the schedule was a little more favorable. So I do think it's the best Spurs team that I've ever seen. And, of course, the irony of that is, you know, they do have the best record in franchise history. They're going to win, what, 66, 67, maybe 68 games, and they're going to be second in the Western Conference. We're all looking forward to the Western Conference final matchup between the Warriors and the Spurs, right?
Oh, yeah.
I don't think the Spurs are going to be favored in that matchup, but I think they're capable of beating the Warriors in a seven-game series, and I think they may be the only team capable of beating the Warriors in a seven-game series, but everything's going to have to fall in place for them to do it. They're all going to have to be healthy. They're going to have to have a little bit of luck, and they're going to have to play their best basketball to do it, because the Warriors are, you know, well, they're just amazing. I mean, they're about to at least match the best record in NBA history. I don't know that they're going to get to 73. They have to play the Spurs twice. But, you know, I won't be surprised if they do. And so here's the irony of the best team in this great 20-year run by the Spurs. Any other year, they might be a lock to win the championship. Not this year.
Yeah. Beginning in the second round, that playoffs in the Western Conference is going to be just wild. And
right. I mean, they're probably going to face Oklahoma City in the second round.
Yeah.
And Oklahoma City's playing great basketball right now. Not yesterday, but they're playing great basketball, and they have two of the best players in the league, and two guys who are capable of winning games in spite of, right?
Yeah.
They've got some holes on that team. I don't think they play great defense. I don't think they have a great bench. They have a few players they're going to have to sort of cover up, but, you know, would it be shocking if the Oklahoma City Thunder beat the Spurs in a second-round series? No, it wouldn't. So this is going to be an unbelievable Western Conference playoff.
Before I let you go, one of the things I thought was fascinating with this team is that historically with the Spurs, you've had an older player kind of give way to a younger player, whether it was Robinson and Duncan, Duncan and Tony Parker, Parker to Kawhi Leonard. This is one of the few times where they've got two guys kind of in their prime. I don't know if we want to call it wrestling for the face of the franchise tag, but in Kawhi and LaMarcus Aldridge, what have you seen from the relationship between those two guys? And do you see that relationship being a sustainable one for, say, the next 5 years?
That is really a good question. It's hard to gauge because you're talking about two guys that are among the most, how should I put it, keep to themselves guys in the league. Kawhi is truly reticent to reveal anything about himself, and LaMarcus may be number two on the team in that regard. It's funny, though, because we talked to LaMarcus after their win the other night, in which he had 31 points and 15 rebounds, but Kawhi scored a career-high 33 points. And he was asked about, you know, his relationship with Kawhi, and he basically said, well, you know, we're not BFF. We've barely talked to each other. And that's because Kawhi is his own guy. face of the franchise, you know, if you forced me to choose right now, I'd say it's Kawhi Leonard. LaMarcus really has come on over the last month. Three of his last four games, he's had at least 31 and 12. There is room for both of them to be dominant players right at this point. It's possible for them to have more games like the Saturday night game where, you know, they both score in the 30s. Jeff McDonald from the Express News had a piece in this morning's paper describing them as the new two. You know, you've got the big three and now the new two. Face of the franchise, I think this is going to be Kawhi Leonard because I think he's going to get better and better, which is scary. But the guy works so hard on his game. I mean, whoever thought he could be a, what, 47% three-point shooter? So that's going to be a real interesting dynamic moving forward is can these two guys, you know, coexist on the same team? I don't see the I don't see it as a problem in the future, and in part of that it has to do with, you know, with Greg Popovich, who doesn't tolerate anything but being a great teammate. You know, he engenders a family atmosphere among the team. So, but it is going to be something interesting to follow next season and the season beyond and the season beyond that.
Well, Mike, I appreciate the time. You've continued to do a great job down there covering the Spurs, first for the Express News, now obviously for the Rivard Report. Thanks for a few minutes here, and I'll catch you down the road.
All right, Chris, it was a pleasure for me, so call anytime.
Thanks, Mike. Appreciate it. And that's it for this week's podcast. My thanks to Rodney Hood of the Denver Nuggets and Mike Monroe, longtime San Antonio Spurs beat writer. Make sure you download this podcast and archived episodes along with the Vertical Podcast with Woj and the Vertical Podcast with JJ Redick on iTunes, Stitcher, TuneIn, anywhere you can download podcasts. Catch you next week.
This has been a digital media production. Find your voice.